This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the median new home sales price exceed $420,000 in May of 2025? Well, the yes forecast contract recently traded at 37% and the no was at 61%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change, the economy, and even politics. You choose yes or no. And if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore trending data on new home sales prices. You can spot the trends. You can make predictions for May 2025 because you could trade future contracts at Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every contract that has a correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Last trading day for this contract is June 23rd.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The economy, it looks okay, but retailers saying otherwise. The big, beautiful bill, it's on its way through the sausage factory, and spec tech like Quantum stocks still in rally mode. Our guest today, Tom Nelson from Franklin Templeton Funds. All this and much more on episode number 922 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, here we are at the tail end of May. In fact, the last show, I think it's the last show of May 2025. Let me do a quick check. I think that is the factual situation right there. Yeah, it is. Next show is actually going to be dead on the 1st of June. Major averages are posting some solid numbers, and there's, I think, a renewed sense that everything's going to be okay. Everything's just... discontinue and carry on, all is going to be just fine. And that was, I think, really the demarcation point of that feeling was when they decided that maybe the tariffs are not the best idea in the world and let's go on a world tour to try to drum up some business. Because deals are being fired off and promises made. And I think the idea that is being presented is things are going to be much better. We broke something, we fixed it, so there's no net positive to that, but we're not going to do any more damage. At least that's what the inclination of most investors are right now, and that's what they're feeling. Hey there, I'm Andrew Horowitz, coming to you from our studios inside of Horowitz & Company's offices in the steam room city of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It is hot out. It's end of May into June. Summer's about to hit, but, you know, and I found a really interesting stat the other day, a little tidbit. That in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the high temp in history, I think it was in 1944, was 100 degrees. Now, I know a lot of people think that Florida is this hot, impressively difficult to deal with temperate zone, but the truth is we only got to 100 degrees. Now, I'll tell you something. That's okay. Because 90 degrees in Florida with 80% humidity or whatever the humidity we have here is making it feel like it's 120. So there's that too. Let's talk about what's going on in the markets. Did you see the crypto space? I mean, Bitcoin is hitting new highs as the genius bill is providing some excitement to the sector. Everybody's all ramped up and jammed up and excited about the fact that this is a real thing. And if we can get the governments behind it, this small float essentially that we have for this is going to start pushing this up to incredible levels. Now, we're going to talk about this with our guest, Anthony Scaramucci, who is coming this summer. to a podcast called The Disciplined Investor Near You. And he is the expert on this, right? I saw him actually this week on a few different programs and read some of the things that he was talking about. And he again is talking about how it's being accepted a lot more by institutions, but more so the small float and the ability for the hope for countries to put money into this is something that is sparking a lot of interest. We also saw the economic numbers this week. Housing, interesting. We saw soft numbers generally in terms of numbers of homes, existing and new, pending sales, all the different numbers that come into the housing market. I think they were soft. And at the same time, prices remain strong. In fact, rising for existing houses. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about what's going on in relation to the current cost of capital. But yet, it's happening. And the inference we're getting from manufacturing and services, which still looks strong, numbers out last week on Thursday provided that. And the inference there that is that consumers are out there still spending. Yet retailers are telling us a much different story. And not so much about the backward view, but they're talking about what they see happening now and the changes they see into the future. So the big question that we've been wrestling with here is, what do we believe? Do we believe in the anecdotal data, the soft data of what's happening with the conference calls, the commentary, the outlooks, the guidance, or do we just believe what we just saw? Now, I know there is a desire for us to look at the silver lining, the glass half full, and the hope that we're going to be able to get out of this mess that has been created artificially and somewhat created also from years and years of bad management, or decades of bad management. So I know that we want to have that feeling that things are good and we're going to do our best to discount the commentary that comes out from the retailers. It's like, well, you know, they came out with good numbers. Are they just sandbagging? Are they just trying to reduce down the outlook for the future so that they can come in and then beat? I mean, there's some interesting comments there and thoughts. But the problem I'm having right now is that everyone has said that really they're starting to see problems creep up with cost factors related to the tariffs, which is hopefully the last time I'll mention that this whole show, at least me. I don't know if our guests will start talking about it. We'll have a discussion there. But they've all talked about June being the time when they're going to start to see price increases. Remember something. If you look at how things work, it takes a while for things to trickle down. And one of the reasons is that the cost of the goods that they already had in inventory don't necessarily need to be increased. So let's say they have 3 months of inventory on hand that was pre-tariff. Well, they could sell that for maybe a little bit more, make some more profits because the assumption was that there are some costs associated with these tariffs inside of the pricing already, but they could actually hold off for a while. And what they did was they sell through that inventory. But when we get to the bottom of that inventory, when there's no more left at those prices that they incurred, that's when they're going to start moving up. And the date that everybody's seemingly been talking about is sometime in June. So that's what's going on there. Now, I think we'll talk about this a lot more with Tom Nelson. But here's an interesting tidbit that I think says a lot about where management's heads are, where the CFOs and treasurers and chairs, presidents, CEOs, all these are looking at what should we explain and how are we going to tell investors what our thoughts are. And FactSet does a great job at putting together all this data and information. And they have something called a document search, which allows users to search for keywords or phrases across multiple document types. And that was used for this to look for the word recession in the conference call transcripts of all the S&P 500 companies that conducted earnings calls and conference calls from March 15th through May 15th. 2 months and a block of names reported during that period. So this is what FactSet has said. Of those companies, 121 cited the term recession during their earnings call for the first time, for the first quarter. Now that number was well above the five-year average, which is 79, and the 10-year average of 59. The number is also more than nine times higher than the number recorded in the previous quarter. It's only 13 times in the previous quarter. Now we're talking about 121. In fact, this quarter marks the highest number of S&P 500 companies citing the word recession for a quarter since the fourth quarter of 2022. That number was 147. And when you look at that and you think about what is that, I think it has to be this general consternation about this untenable amount of debt that we have, along with the pricing issues that we see. And this debt that we have, let's be honest, it's not going away anytime soon. I think, unfortunately, we're realizing that the spending is not going, it's just not going to be reduced. Even though this whole hubbubaloo about Dodge, Doge, whatever you want to call it, Elon Musk, Department of Government Efficiency, ha ha ha, we use that acronym again. There's still this massive amount of spending in the, yes, dare I say, the big and beautiful bill. Sure, this tax cuts. There's cuts to spending. But on the whole, when you look at the tax cuts, the cuts to spending, the spending that's going to go on, the spending still outweighs the cuts by a massive, dare I say, never been the likes of what we have seen before, spending that could amount to trillions of dollars. Which is precisely why inside that bill that is being worked on increases the debt ceiling by a whopping $4 trillion, dare I say it again, $4 trillion with all those trailing zeros. So if you're wondering what the deal was regarding to why markets are holding up to a degree, yeah, there was a couple of sell-offs last week. There's the hope that the money, and that's what brought us into, right, the lower tariffs and this bill, there's this hope, there's this perception that maybe even though we're spending way more than we should be, that perhaps that spending is actually going to be good for markets, as those kinds of monies usually trickle down into the speculative assets, into the hands of the investors that are investing in the markets. Now, at the same time, notice something. I think you need to notice something very carefully. We saw bond yields hurdle higher. I mean, jump. Now they're at 4.6% on the 10-year. 30-year mortgages over 7%. And that's something that we need to understand and really focus in on of why it is happening, because that is not going to be good for the housing market. That's not going to be good for companies that want to refinance their debt. That's not going to be good for people that are borrowing money on, whether it's credit cards, lines of credit, small companies in particular will be hit the hardest. So when we look at what is going on right now, we have to question, why are we seeing this kind of situation? Why are we seeing that bond rates are going up? It's the lack of confidence in the U.S., the ability, especially after we saw the Fitch downgrade last week. That Fitch downgrade is now percolating in the background, realizing that, Moody's. Fitch downgraded years ago, but Moody's, the first time since, I think, 1919, that they actually downgraded the U.S. debt to AA1 from AAA. No longer do we have any of the highest ratings for our debt from any of the rating services, even though Treasury Secretary Bessent says it's backward looking. Do you think that if it was upgraded, he'd say it's backward looking? No. These are just talking points and ways that they try to obfuscate and diffuse the reality. So there you have it, what's going on right now and why there still is confusion in the markets. VIX hit above 20 again, not terribly high, but above norms, and markets saw some volatility. starting to see the valuations are coming into question now, especially when we see yields start to rise as they have. So keep in mind all of that as we're investing right now and as we go through our conversation with our upcoming guest, who I like very much, full disclosure, a really good friend of mine, Tom Nelson. Let's take a moment to talk about Interactive Brokers, because Interactive Brokers, you know this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. They have these incredibly important, these key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 4.83% to 5.83%, and that's rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Now, you can compare IBKR's low margin borrowing cost to other brokers like whether it's Schwab, E-Trade, Fidelity, Vanguard, who may charge hundreds of basis points more. Now, of course, rates are subject to change, but margin is an important thing to understand. And of course, it's only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance, because you may lose more than your initial investment by leveraging up. Check it out, because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to ibkr.com/compare. Let me do a quick introduction. Tom Nelson is the Senior Vice President and Head of Asset Allocation Portfolio Management at Franklin Templeton Investment Solutions. He's a member of the Investment Strategy and Research Committee. He's a portfolio manager of a number of funds offered for sale in various jurisdictions around the world. He is a lead portfolio manager at the Franklin Next Step Fund Series, Vol Smart Allocation, Life Smart Retirement. He's been there since 2007 and co-founded the firm's Quantitative Research Services Group upon joining the company. So pretty deep piece of information and a bright gentleman. Let's bring him right on. All right, let's get right to our guest, Tom Nelson. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. You know, I mentioned to everybody right before we started with good friends, and you and I were talking about some of the plans we're making for all of the, maybe Memorial Day weekend. But, it's May already is my point. It's the end of May is the point.
Yeah.
And we've had a lot happen this year. And then markets have gone through a lot of gyrations. And I think that what's really fascinating, what I want to talk to you about, and I want you to discuss a little bit about the last 6-8 weeks, the rally off the bottom, the V recovery once again that we've seen, that is once again training people to just, hey, market goes down. Oh, yeah. Pavlovian says to put money into work. So yeah. I think you and I had talked about that this technical, this sentiment-driven.
Sure.
Where are we? What happened? And where, what do you kind of feel and see?
Yeah. It's been a really interesting start to the year, right? And I checked my Bloomberg at about 10:30 this morning, and the year-to-date total return on the S&P basically matched Mr. Blutarsky's grade point average at Faber College, if you remember. Animal House, 0.0, it was like 0.01% total return year to date. So if you closed your eyes, you would have thought that nothing had happened.
That's great.
Look, we've been through the largest upheaval, the global trade in over 100 years, the biggest pivot in German fiscal policy since the reunification in 1990. And we're in the midst of the most significant reassessment of U.S. geopolitical leadership since World War II, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking and moving forward to the last, call it 6 weeks or so, April 2nd was Liberation Day, the announcement of some pretty broad and high levels of tariffs beyond what I think most of us had predicted. And even before that, the markets had peaked in late February, I think it was the 19th, and we're down close to 20%.
But quickly. I mean, it was straight down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the rally, that subsequent rally that we've seen, which has brought us back to basically unchanged year to date, was first, I think the catalyst, if you will, was on April the 9th, the administration in the U.S. coming out and putting kind of a 90-day pause on implementation of tariffs, which gave us an opportunity to negotiate with various countries and Europe as a whole, if you will. And at that point in time, sentiment and positioning And technicals, I think all three of them were very much one-sided, and maybe starting with technicals. Some of the long-term technical indicators that we track had reached oversold conditions on the NASDAQ, on the S&P, on small caps, on high yield. So pretty much all risk assets, if you will. These don't occur all that frequently, just 18 times over the last 30 plus years for the S&P. And when you reach those levels, kind of everyone's on one side of the boat, if you will, and forward 1 year returns are roughly double that of average annual returns and are positive much more frequently than normal, right? And those are more neutral today. Sentiment, based upon a number of measures that we track, were extremely pessimistic, like bottom percentile versus history in things like there's a Ned Davis Daily Trading Sentiment Composite. It's a composite of all of their sentiment indicators. It's, you know, kind of taking the pulse of what investors are feeling. Lowest percentile versus 30-year history. When that occurs, the average three-month return to the S&P, subsequent three-month return, is over 10%. And next 12-month returns are over 20%. And so, you know, from a sentiment perspective, you had everybody on one side of the boat. Everybody's feeling pessimistic and everybody is worried, right? And then actual positioning, similarly, was very much defensive. So, you know, a couple of different cohorts. So hedge fund managers were positioned quite defensively in their net positioning, their longs versus their shorts. And then also kind of non-discretionary managers. And these are investors who typically manage like rules-based portfolios. So, for example, if volatility rises to certain levels, they have to hedge portfolios and sell stocks in order to keep below certain volatility levels. And they were at some of their lowest equity positioning ever due to the high volatility levels that we had seen in kind of early April. And so when everybody is all packed into one side and we had this catalyst, this relief from tariffs, that just caused kind of a rip-roaring rally. And then, you know, to add fuel to that fire, we've seen some breadth thrusts, for example. And kind of the breadth thrust is when you have positioning that's quite weak, where the percentage of stocks that are advancing relative to the total stocks in a market, when that moves from extremely weak to extremely strong levels in a short period of time, that was triggered about 2 weeks ago. And that was only the eighth time since 2008 using stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. And that for us is a really strong signal with really strong returns over the subsequent 1, 3, 6, and 12 month periods. And so you have sentiment, you have positioning, and you have technicals, all of which are fairly short term in nature, leaning in one direction. And all it really took was kind of, you know, one match to take and ignite a rip-roaring rally and over, you know, 20 plus percent that we've seen since the bottoms in mid-April, if you will.
If I'm not mistaken, that breadth thrust, I think Tom McClelland talked about that also on one of my shows, but that breadth thrust, there hasn't been that many, but I think there's been a couple more recently, hasn't there? Yes.
Yeah. And it kind of depends upon which index you look at, whether it's the New York Stock Exchange or the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, but it has triggered a few times recently across a number of different indices. And those are really strong short-term signals.
You know, I don't know if it feels like we've been here before, but I want to read something to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. I want you to think back just for a moment, maybe six weeks ago or whatever, right around there, right? When things, markets, investors roaming around in the dark, companies pulling guidance, zero visibility on earnings. Then we get the FOMO trade kicking in. Markets rally after some stimulus. Well, in this case, it was a little bit different. Stimulus was a reversal, right? Whatever it takes, playing out as expected after a bone-crushing week for markets, investors looking for value, still tight liquidity, so squeezing higher, seeing some amazing ingenuity, companies, you know, doing things to try to make sure they have enough earnings, et cetera. You know when I wrote that? That was 3/25 of 2020. Oh. I have a full.
That was COVID.
Yeah. But does it sound familiar?
Oh, very familiar. Yeah.
I can go through this. This is, I had weekly, if not more often, that was 320. On 330, stimulus bill being passed, right? That's kind of like what we have going on now. Yeah. You know, psychology of these kinds of investment scenarios. Market snapped back 18% last week off of the bottom. Yeah. You know, that's on 330. I did this once a week for months just to make sure this broad pool Q&A on Mondays in the afternoon when everything was shut down. I came to the office and I did all these webinars for people, right? But you can go to this, you know, where are we? Was it a black swan event? No one was prepared for this type of situation. Yes, the economy is still solid and coming through, but what can we compare this to? Is it a wartime? Is it a global war? I mean, all this is very familiar.
Yeah.
Without being confined to our houses. But that was under Trump also, by the way, just to be clear.
That was.
History, I don't know if there's a playbook going on here or something.
History does rhyme. Yeah. It may not repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Right.
And using history as a guide can be extremely useful in times like these.
But that was obviously a very good, that was 5 years ago, almost to, well, you know, if we're talking about this on 325, I mean, that's basically the time period, right?
Yeah.
Of what we're talking about, how everything came down, went crazy. Now, when we look at this now, though, and we plug in the sentiment that we talked about, and we then add to that what the sentiment is looking for, right? Sentiment was low, now it's like high. Everybody's euphoric now. Everybody wants to get in, right? We see the cheerleading team for markets will always be there. We know the mechanical nature. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about my market mechanics thesis and the idea that the market mechanics, people ask me like, why are the markets like generally, why do they generally go up? Now I can give this great answer like, well, you know, we have the best companies in the world and ingenuity and their technology and they're doing this and they're, but there's also something else. There's market mechanics. The market mechanics are basic. That when you have people working, they're getting money. When they take that money, and particularly that money that's taken out of their paychecks on a regular basis and put into their 401k plans, it's a daily, weekly, monthly routine that happens, and that puts money into the market. There is a baseline of money mechanically being invested, dollar cost averaging, if you will, automatically into the markets.
Yeah.
Where you see the biggest problems, in my opinion, is when that dynamic changes. When all of a sudden you start seeing massive layoffs and we go from a 4.2% unemployment rate to, pick a number, right? 5%, 8%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And all of a sudden that market mechanics starts doing some funny things. But investors need to understand the difference between the bad news and how markets react are not always aligned, right? So here we are. What has changed? We got a reprieve, Tom, on the tariffs.
Yep.
Maybe that was part of the plan. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I mean, we'll never know.
Right.
But in the end, we still have to deal with that. We're going to get to these points. More importantly, we have this massive debt overhang with the 10-year clipping 4.6% this week, the upper end of the range. Are you concerned about, even though we have the mechanics, the high level of enthusiasm that we have now, considering the debt that we have, or maybe there's something else I'm missing here?
Yeah, specifically on the debt and treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
We are so somewhat concerned. And you know, the bond market is kind of the ultimate arbiter of kind of greed and fear, if you will. And the market has not liked what is going on as it pertains to the U.S.'s kind of fiscal situation right now, and the tax deal. As of about an hour or so ago, the most read story on Bloomberg of the day, the headline is Trump's next hurdle: the bond market hates his beautiful bill.
Yeah, well, right.
And so that, you know, that sums up a couple of things from that perspective. But look, that we saw a debt downgrade on Friday of last week, right? That was from Moody's.
Mm-hmm.
And
first
that was
first time since 1919. I don't think Bessent was. Earlier in the show, I talked about this idea that Bessent said that's a rearview mirror. That's old. That's lagging. You know, would you agree that if it was an upgrade that we said, well, that's because of our doing.
I think the rhetoric might be different on an upgrade. But look, Moody's was the third of the three major ratings agencies to downgrade treasuries from AAA to AA, right? The first one was actually in August of 2011. That was from S&P. So let's call it 14 years ago. And then Fitch in 2023. So it's kind of likely a matter of time for Moody's to follow suit. It wasn't really, you know, new news, if you will. I do think that the fact that it came at a time when the tax bill was being negotiated was probably a sign for Moody's that they themselves are concerned about further ballooning of the fiscal deficit, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The concerns, I think, are generally around revenues, whether that's tariffs or otherwise, being insufficient to counterbalance reduced tax revenues, right? And so, you know, that's kind of on where we stand. Also, maybe on top of that, it hasn't really received a lot of headlines, but if you look at the term structure of U.S. government debt, so just kind of like year by year, how much in terms of U.S. treasuries are coming due, nearly half of all U.S. government notes and bonds. So I'm not including T-bills, which, you know, are issued and they mature within 1 year. But notes and bonds, nearly half of them will be maturing by the end of 2028. So that debt is likely going to need to be rolled over into new debt. And part of the issue that we have there is that interest rates today are higher than they've been over, you know, really since the end of the global financial crisis, with some kind of fits and starts there. So if you're to look at the average coupon on treasuries maturing in the next, call it 2.5 years, it's about 2.75%. Mm-hmm. Now today, pretty much all US treasuries yield, call it 4 to 4.5%. With the very long end, the 30-year point of the curve at 5%. So if that debt that's coming due in the next 2.5 years is rolled over at, call it a 4% coupon, it's a fairly conservative estimate based upon where yields are today, the total interest costs on U.S. Treasuries, so all of them, not just the ones that are being rolled over, but the interest cost on U.S. Treasuries would be roughly 14% higher, or an incremental $85 billion per year. And with a new tax bill that many people feel may be lacking on, you know, incremental revenues to cover these kinds of things, that just makes the problem worse. And the bond market is basically saying, hey, look, guys, you got to get your fiscal house in order.
Isn't it very clear that the revenue is not going to be able to sufficiently cover the cost factors if they're putting in there a $4 trillion increase to the debt ceiling, which is currently at $36 trillion, and we're banging up against it?
Yeah.
So it seems to me that maybe they're thinking that it may not happen all at once, of course, but the bond market and everybody does believe that this is a spending bill. And while all the talk over Doge and all this is great, the fact still remains that there's excess spending going on. Yep. And or should I say, maybe not spending. That's a bad thing to say. There's a combination of spending and lack of revenue.
Revenues to cover.
To cover.
Yeah. Yep.
So what do we do as bond investors at that point, right? Do we stay uber low maturity, low duration? Do we span it out and do some kind of other strategy? I mean, what do you do in your asset allocation? I know you can't talk about exactly what you do from compliance purposes, but generally speaking, you know, what is the concept that you would think about doing from a portfolio that has bonds in it?
Yeah. So particularly in terms of, you know, like government bonds and in terms of treasuries, there is concern over, we just talked about kind of the fiscal situation in the U.S. And so there is concerns about yields being higher. Now, inflation also, we haven't talked much about that, but, you know, the expectation is that inflation is likely to be higher from tariffs, and where things ultimately end up on that is in some ways anybody's guess, but it's going to be higher. It's probably going to be higher for a fairly short period of time, right? Prices will rise due to tariffs and then they'll kind of stay there, but they may settle in it at levels above what the Federal Reserve likes to have as kind of a neutral level of inflation. And that's going to if that comes to fruition, would lead to higher long-term interest rates as well. And so a way to kind of play things to pick up some yield and to reduce risk overall and reduce the impact of higher interest rates, should interest rates go higher from here, is to stay in the shorter end of the yield curve, right? So that could be in anything, 2 years and shorter, where yields in that region are still upwards of 4%. So pretty decent relative to history. And you're not necessarily foregoing as much yield as you are historically with the yield curve fairly flat. We do also still like corporate bonds, and U.S. profitability has remained resilient. There are some potential concerns if growth should falter. That tends to be more at lower rated companies, but getting some corporate bond exposure in your portfolio is helpful. That picks up some incremental yield. You do take on some credit risk there. And then maybe finally, securitized mortgage-backed products that are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government are offering yields at a decent premium to treasuries today. But overall, we would advocate having a little less interest rate sensitivity, which would mean being at the shorter end of the yield curve.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem to me the risk-return trade-off is even reasonable right now of anything, longer than a number of years, because you're still going to earn the same yield on it. And the chance of rates coming down significantly, I'm not talking about, in 25 basis points increments. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about significant reduction. It is pretty hard to imagine unless there is something that triggers a massive economic downturn that's just so disruptive and destructive. Yep. I just don't see it. I agree. I agree with that. So
the one caveat to that on your economic downturn would be an economic downturn that comes with lower levels of inflation too.
Right.
And there's almost as much of a probability of stagflation. So economic slowdown with higher levels of inflation than there is with a economic slowdown with low levels of inflation, which is more common, right?
Stagflation is something that's talked about a billion times more than it actually happens.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, the stagflation that has ever occurred has it been like twice, literally twice in history?
Yeah. Yeah.
But we talk about it like every year. Like, it's a stag. Now it's going to come again one day for some crazy reason. And that's bad. Yep. That's a bad situation. So, but yeah, I think that's it's going to be interesting. So, the idea of alternatives I want to talk to you about, because we've been searching for years for good positioning in our portfolios for clients where we could add some true diversification. Because again, stocks, bonds, real estate, they kind of have diversification because they are definitely differing categories. And historically, we can prove that. However, on a short term, sometimes like in 2022, it doesn't work so well.
Right.
But when you look at alternatives and you find those that are outside the range of correlation with investments that are the most popular, your stocks and bonds. Tell me what you do in your team, because I know you work, in the asset allocation. So that comes up. This has to come up, right? Am I right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me, what is that would be, first of all, like the Holy Grail, the light is shining and there's a halos above whatever this investment is. And there's a glow and a slight musical, what I mean? What is that? What's Nirvana in that area?
Yeah, so Nirvana, which we're still searching for it, and we may, always be searching for it, would be assets that have no correlation or a negative correlation, ideally, to your traditional stocks and bonds. So diversifiers, and have strong returns and stable returns, if you will, right? And so if you think about diversification through low correlation of assets, the addition of those assets will lower the risk of your portfolio. And if you can do that with assets that have a positive expected return and a highly positive expected return, that could be return increasing, right? And so the way to improve your risk-adjusted returns are to lower your risk or increase your returns, all else being equal, without the incremental increase in risk, or both, right? And so I guess nirvana would be return enhancing as well as risk reducing. And
oh, I like that. That's good.
For the most part, alts do provide risk reduction. There are some assets though that help with increasing returns as well. They tend to be private assets. So private alternatives, whether it's private equity or private real estate or private credit. And that is where we are seeing the largest amount of demand for inclusion in portfolios today.
Yeah, it's interesting because I find that people want protection, but yet when you sometimes go through a series of market movements, and particularly those that are just seemingly higher, they question it. Like, why do I need this? It's kind of like, why do I need, why do I need speed bumps on a straight road when nobody's on it, let's say? Or why do I need, some kind of safety when this seems to be no risk?
Right.
And
why pay for insurance when you're healthy?
Right, exactly. Which, isn't that the point, though? Didn't you just sum it up right there? Yeah.
Yes.
It's the insurance. It's the insurance. That's the point. It's the insurance.
Yeah.
And not everybody, a lot of people try to put this on top of people of invest. I've seen portfolios. I'm like, what's going on with this? Well, I'm, this investment. I'm like, what's going on here? Why do you have all this? Well, we talked about with the advisor that they want to have some protection. I'm like, you're not going anywhere. You know, if you put your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time, you're not going anywhere.
Mm. Yep.
You're just spending gas and wearing out your brake liners, right? So. Yeah. That's the true definition of spinning your wheels. And you don't need that either. There needs to be a healthy dose of it because look, let's talk about this. Let's say you have a true hedge, right? A hedge, when I say hedge, just something that is 100% uncorrelated or fully, we'll say in easy parlance for investors, opposite. The market goes up, this goes down. The market goes down, this goes up. Okay, got that?
Yep.
Now you have a 95% of your portfolio that's invested. And you say, I'm going to do a 5% hedge. How did that help?
Right.
You're not going to feel it on the way up. I tell you something else. You're not going to feel it on the way down either because you're not going to get any kind of benefit. So those kinds of things, I mean, we do that in our trading portfolios. We put, 15% hedge and 10% cash. Well, that kind of gives you a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people shouldn't be fooled with the fact of what actually these can do. This needs to get right, and I'm setting you up here. It needs to be combined with the full asset allocation, which is your specialty.
Correct.
And tell us like what that looks like.
In terms of portfolio construction. And
like what is, in your opinion, a person mm-hmm. who sits on top of the asset allocation funds, the target date funds and all that, and your investment committees. What is that what is that mission statement on Franklin Templeton's wall, in theory, that talks about asset allocation and what your job is?
Yeah. And so our job is to construct portfolios across a broad suite of asset classes that provide diversification and a fairly smooth ride for investors. Really, regardless of what the objective is that they are seeking to meet, right? And so we always start with kind of what's the money for? What do you want to be able to achieve? And that can run the gamut from, to your point of target date funds, being able to safely save for retirement and build up a nest egg that is going to endure throughout an investor's retirement years. It could be income-oriented strategies to provide that income and that decumulation phase of someone's life cycle. It could be we have a set of liabilities and we need to be able to match those liabilities and provide some spending needs. And so it's really kind of taking what people are seeking to be able to achieve and constructing a portfolio with a number of different asset classes that meet those objectives. And, you know, oftentimes it's the retirement savings, the education savings in like 529 plans, or just your traditional kind of balanced type of portfolios, but can really run the gamut. And it's taking all the different asset classes that might be out there that we can access and constructing a portfolio that meets that objective.
So how now I'm going to segue into, should I do gold first and Bitcoin? No, let's talk about, I want to spend a little time. Okay. Let's talk about gold. Let's talk about gold and those things. Those are, not uncorrelated, but they're less correlated, right? Mm-hmm. They could be moments that they're correlated, but generally speaking over time, gold, silver, certain commodities. I think I've been telling you about my struggles with commodities lately. Did I tell you about that?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still not fully sold on the whole idea of long-term holding commodities in the portfolio that have upper price limits due to consumption restraints.
Right.
That includes, I guess, soft foods, mm-hmm. and maybe some consumable oil. I don't mean edible. I meant like, you know, oils and energy
products. Yeah.
You know, but you look at some of the other things like gold, nickel, platinum, those things, those could be used forever and price can go up. There's limitations and overhead resistance on those, but they still have a bitter side. But anyway, gold is a hedge. And I want to kind of bring that into the concept of having all these different investments. And one of the ones that I think people don't have as much as they could is a true alt. Right. So commodities, are they all? Yeah, they're alternative to stocks, mm-hmm. you know, but a true alt is something like an arbitrage fund, a fund or a strategy that maybe utilizes to a degree, maybe call option writing. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something that's a headline driven trading. Maybe there's how about this? Commodities, but commodity trading. Right, you know, commodity trading,
yeah,
or maybe credit arbitrage, right? Those are, and my listeners are probably like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah,
so those are alts, and it's only been a matter of time that we've had the ability to use those for the everyday investor, rather than going to a hedge fund where you have to pony up $25 million,
right.
Are those things that are high on the scale of an asset allocator's, yeah, we like that?
They are. And I hesitate a little bit because there are a couple of kind of conditions. So one is, you know, whether or not the end investor is comfortable with those types of strategies. Two, when we get into alternatives outside of like, you know, gold, you can buy a gold ETF real inexpensively. But oftentimes these types of strategies aren't extraordinarily cheap. But they can be very good diversifiers. And so there are, for example, a couple of strategies that are managed by our team that we leverage in some portfolios for investors where it's appropriate that have, they basically seek to do what a lot of different types of hedge fund strategies will invest in, and they harvest various risk premia. So in commodities, it could be trading in certain places on the yield curve, dependent upon where the shape of commodities yield curves. It could be the fact that certain currencies have carry, and there's some arbitrage opportunities there. But in a strategy that allocates to these different premia, these different kind of risk factors, with daily liquidity, with low correlation or basically zero correlation to stocks and bonds can be really useful in portfolios. Now, the risk of those strategies tends to be fairly low, and therefore the expected return is fairly low as well, but positive. And so you either have to kind of lever them up a little bit to get incremental returns or incremental expected returns, or accept, you know, fairly low levels of return, and your risk-adjusted returns are going to be better, but through risk reduction. And at the end of the day, potentially at the expense of higher returns, but smoother returns, if you will. But those are strategies we've been allocating to for like 10 plus years.
But one of the things that's interesting is that in some regards, they have the same risk profile as, let's say, intermediate term bonds. Let's say, right?
That's
what you get out of it. But with intermediate bonds, you're stuck. You do have much more potential volatility because it's potentially the way it is. And at least there's limited upside on that.
Right.
Whereas you do have some upside at least. And you have, again, something outside the spectrum that maybe you have intermediate term corporate bonds and all of a sudden there's a big, you know, recession coming and the corporate bonds go to crapper.
Right.
And all right, you wait it out. That's fine. But here you don't have that maybe in one of the old positions, you don't have that kind of economic exposure as an example, right? I mean,
So completely immune to what happens to corporate credit worthiness and therefore intermediate term bonds.
Yeah. So, is that something that, can be utilized as an offset to maybe bond exposure or is that, you still keep that in a separate box?
Yeah, that would typically be something like that. When we allocate to those types of strategies in portfolios, it tends to be mostly pulled from our fixed income exposure. So again, depending upon kind of the risk tolerance of the client, ballpark kind of 75% of the allocation would come from fixed income into this, and maybe 25% would come out of stocks.
I'm assuming that most portfolios or most, you know, asset allocation models, if you will, don't have a really big position here. We're talking about what maximum of 8%, something like that?
Yeah. And 5 to 10% was the number that I was going to quote.
Yep, so
pretty much right in the middle of that.
Right there. I think there's some really interesting things. If you can find something at a reasonable cost factor, because some of these are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these are actually, but here's what's really interesting. You can get into investors. I'm talking to you, listeners. Listen up. You can actually, what I think is really cool, is get hedge funds that you will not be available to you inside of these, and mm-hmm. basically have a portion of your portfolio that, look, you can walk on the golf course, you can go to your cocktail party and say, hey, I got this hedge fund in my portfolio now. Seriously, you can't do that. Some big names that are mm-hmm. inside some of these that utilize their, Reg 40 funds exposure to actually emulate the hedge fund.
Yep.
Without a 2-in-20 structure, by the way.
That's correct. Yeah.
So now you can say, I got it. Not only did I get into it, I got into it much cheaper than most of the big guys.
I'm looking at one right now that has an expense ratio of 0.65%.
Yeah, that's it.
Flat.
That's it.
Yeah.
So usually you're going to be 2-in-20. And that needs to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it needs to be essentially a duplication of the hedge fund.
Yeah.
Now the question then asks, wait a second, why? How is that possible? Well, the hedge funds use this as a, let's call it a cash cow. They allocate some of this money in this large amounts. They get money in, essentially they don't have to borrow it, lever it at all. And they get it at a much cheaper rate to them, but they get it, in big blocks that they have no management of. They don't have to deal with the clients and all that. It's much easier one block to work with. And it's very easy, but it's a cash cow for them because the money just keeps rolling in from the management fee, right?
Yes.
Is that how, that's how I look at it.
Yeah. And gains access to a much broader potential audience of investors, right?
Yeah. Cool stuff. So looking forward, with all the discussion we just had and all the things we're talking about with the tariff and the things happening there, the economic, what's your take on the messaging that we're seeing right now from corporations about their outward view of having to increase prices or their negative view, even though we saw Target, which had a pretty ugly view. Home Depot said things are slowing down, although they reaffirmed. Lowe's the same thing. The list goes on, right? What's your take on the outlook versus the current reality?
Yeah, a lot of it will depend upon where things settle with tariffs, right? But at a very high level, this is going to be negative. Negative for the corporates. Negative for the consumers as well, and in some ways negative for confidence, and we've seen that in a lot of survey data. But specifically with corporations, just let's use Nike as an example, and I don't think they've had any talks of guidance or impacts. But half the shoes that they manufacture are made in the 64 different factories that they have throughout Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. And when Nike shoes made in Nike factories in Vietnam are shipped to the U.S., Nike will be hit with what today is, I think, a 46% tariff, you know, coming from Vietnam, bringing them into the U.S., right? And so Nike, and again, I'm just using this as a fairly random example. We all wear shoes and know the company, but they have a choice, right? If they fully eat that incremental cost from tariffs, their profit margins are going to take a hit. And if their profits go down, that on balance is going to be negative for their stock and negative for the stock market and negative for 401k holders and all that kind of fun stuff, right? If they take and they pass all of that increase in cost to the consumer, we're going to be paying a lot more money for Nike sneakers. And that's going to be negative for the consumer, who right now has, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of, on average across the U.S., like 1% net of inflation wage growth. And if we see that, you know, passing through as higher inflation, that's going to eat away at the consumer and their pocketbook. And so these are really difficult things for people to solve. Nike could potentially, you know, move their manufacturing to another country, but we don't necessarily know today what tariffs are going to be like in other countries. And so, you know, where do you move without knowing what it's going to cost to manufacture somewhere else and all the costs to, you know, to build new factories? And can they bring manufacturing of sneakers to the U.S. and still do that as profitably as they're doing it today? Probably not. And so on net, these things are negative. These things, tariffs, are negative to corporations.
I have a question for clarification.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the reciprocal tariffs that were put on Vietnam, because Vietnam supposedly, between the tariffs charged to the United States, including the currency manipulation and trade barriers, blah, blah, is 90%, which whatever. And the discounted reciprocal tariff that we supplanted on them was 46% on anything coming in. However, I thought we dropped that for 90 days and put only 10%. Am I incorrect?
So you are not incorrect. No, it's a very good point. So I was quoting the number that was as of April the 2nd, right? Yeah,
that's with the Sri Lanka 44%, because we do a lot of business with Sri Lanka, by the way. And the Bangladesh, oh my God, the Bangladesh 37%, because I mean, we rely on Bangladesh for so much.
Yeah. But I think we're on day 43 of that 90-day reprieve right now, right? Mm-hmm. There hasn't been a lot of talk about kind of what happens after 90 days. We, outside of kind of a deal with the UK, who we actually have a trade surplus with, so we don't really have that much of a net trade issue with the UK and China, obviously the de-escalation with China. We haven't heard a lot about other countries. And I think it was last weekend that the messaging was basically, you know, if after 90 days we do not have any deals with these other countries, and it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to make deals with every country in that 90-day period, we're just going to tell them what the tariffs are going to be. And it's probably going to be right around what was quoted,
yeah,
that 46% as of April the 2nd. Again, so much that's still unknown. And when there is so much uncertainty, that causes people to retrench and not make decisions, yeah, right? Yeah. And companies not to do capital expenditures because they don't know what it's going to cost. They don't know what it's going to cost for all of the inputs to build a new factory in the United States and so on and so forth. And so all this uncertainty is just another way of kind of thinking of risk, right? The risk in financial terms is oftentimes equated with uncertainty. And there is a ton of geopolitical uncertainty today.
Yeah, good stuff. Tom Nelson, Franklin Templeton Funds, I appreciate you being with us. And we'll have all the information on the show notes, episode number 922 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
There you have it. What about asset allocation, alternative funds, outlook, issues we're getting related to consumer sentiment, right from the source, and a good source at that. Thank you for joining me on this show, an episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to June, coming up very shortly. Great guests coming up for that as well. Looking forward to talk with Barry Ritholtz next week. Week after, we have some great guests. Next few weeks after that, we have David Gaffin and Steve Sanders, Frank Curzio. I mentioned Anthony Scaramucci. So we're doing it all the way through the summer, as we always do. Make sure to tell your friends, your family, everybody out there that you love, just love, you adore the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You take it on walks. You make sure it's the first thing you do every Sunday afternoon when it pops out and it becomes available on your favorite podcast repository, whether it's YouTube, Amazon, maybe Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the list goes on. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.